Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live. The back of Roberta's Pizzeria in, where is it, Jack?
It's this place called Bushwick.
Bushwick,
that
Brooklyn.
Nastasia hates.
Who won that? That was Elliot Papinow, right? Yeah.
That was Elliot Papinow. Shirt went out in the mail yesterday, man.
That's awesome.
Nice.
Thanks,
nice,
buddy.
Nice. Well, joined as usual with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez, Jack and Joe in the engineering booth. Hey, guys.
Beautiful day out.
Yeah, which Nastasia hates.
That's another thing she hates.
It's not that she hates the weather.
I hate the way people like the weather.
Yeah. You guys are getting a little bit of an insight here. And special guest in the studio today with us, Ariel Johnson, who is a... you're at UC Davis. You're in the enology department, but you're studying right now bitters, correct?
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm studying. I do analytical chemistry and flavor chemistry on bitters and other things.
Right, and you are not a professional or semi-professional. I mean, it dovetails with your profession, but you also privately are a flavor chemical collector. True or false?
Very true.
Yeah, and so how big is your collection now at this point?
Of flavor chemicals?
Yeah.
Like in the lab?
Or just that you have around, you have access to?
Probably 1,000.
Yeah, nice. We, Stas and I, visited a place called David Michael's, which is a flavor house down outside of Philadelphia. And what factory was it right near? It was right near some factory that was making...
Nabisco, I think.
Nabisco? Whole dang place smell like Oreos. Mm-hmm. True or false? Mm-hmm. Until you get in. Anyway. And they make some amazing vanilla. I thought I knew something about vanilla, and I talked to another vanilla guy, and then I realized that, you know, I had not yet been born. In other words, like, I had less knowledge about vanilla than an infant has about the world as they're born. We saw their flavor stuff. It's pretty amazing. Amazing stuff. Any personal favorites right now, Ariel?
Favorite aroma compounds?
Yeah, they, like unusual ones. Like, don't give me some hexanal or any crap like that. Give me some...
No, hexanal's lame.
Yeah, okay.
I quite like rotundone. That's the impact compound for black pepper.
Wait, what's the name of it?
Rotundone.
Rotundone, like rotund.
Yeah.
Done.
It's a 15-carbon sesquiterpene. It's also in Syrah wines.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I love the word... Well, first of all, everyone knows terpene's a great word, but sesqui...
Yeah.
Add sesqui to anything.
1.5.
Yeah. It's a great, you know, it's like we need to have like sesquicentennials more often, right?
Totally.
Sesquicentennials are the bomb. Back when I was a kid, they actually were having sesquicentennials for things like, Civil War. No, it's right now actually, sesquicentennial, right? 150. What's 150 plus?
2011?
Yeah, that was right. Sesquicentennial came up on the thing. When I was a kid, it must have been some other war. Eh, whatever. And a big thank you out to Co Miles, who's not only a supporter of our radio network. Is this true or false, Jack?
Oh, yeah, he is.
And not only an incredibly interesting guy I met at the sous vide class, sous vide low temperature class, I will not reveal his history for fear, but also now an incredibly generous giver of the 5-volume Modernist Cuisine set.
Yeah, I'm going to give him one of these. I mean... It was awesome.
And now I never, ever again will be able to make the excuse, I don't own the books, so I can't tell you what they said.
Yeah.
Right? I vow.
Yeah, I guess you got to read them all now.
I vow never to say that again. Very, very actual and real heartfelt thanks. Thank you very much. I believe he lives in the Houston area, right? Houston?
Not sure.
Anyway, I think so. And by the way, again, he's involved in NASA a little bit. I'm so excited. This summer, late, semi-related to NASA. Anyway, this summer, Stas, are you going down with us when we do the mango tasting?
When you're going.
We're going to do the mango tasting again this year. Harold McGee and I, and maybe Andy Ricker, the chef from Pock Pock, a good friend of ours. And we're going to go – last year, Harold McGee and I went to the Fairchild, which is the world's biggest collection of mangoes, at least the United States' biggest collection of mangoes. And unlike a lot of other mango collections throughout the world, like, for instance, famous mango collections in India or mango collections in Southeast Asia, the Florida one is very interesting because it's South Dade. It's like south of Miami where it's like the very tip where you can actually grow almost anything. You can almost grow mangosteens, not quite. I mean, you can, but not out in the open. Anyways – they specialize in having everything, so like all varieties of mango. And the people out there, who are their names? Norris Liedman, Richard Campbell, I believe, are the two lead people out there. And they are mango nuts and jackfruit nuts. Last time we were rained out, kind of, and also it was a big mess, the visit. But we're going to go again. And when I go down there, I'm taking the kids to Cape Canaveral. Cool. You like that? Because, you know, Dak's obsessed with rockets now.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah, he's like, I want to become some sort of a scientist astronaut. But we'll see. We'll see. You can do it if you want. We'll see. Okay. By the way, Ariel, tell them about the special chromatograph thing you have.
The special chromatograph thing?
Yeah.
The Franken GC?
Yeah.
Okay, so we have a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer, which you use for analyzing the volatiles responsible for aroma in a mixture or a sample. But we have one with a switch and a cold trap that lets us basically remix all the volatiles from a sample or take a few out and have like an omission mixture and then see how that changes the aroma.
Yeah, it's pretty badass, right?
Yeah, it's the only one in the world.
Yeah, and so
we built it.
Who paid for it? Like, in other words, what research had money for it?
I think, honestly, we built it from spare parts.
Really?
Yeah.
So this is one of the rare instances where you get to do something cool in a scientific context and don't need to get big industry to pay for it?
Yeah, we might have had a little bit of National Science Foundation or Jastrow Shields, which is like a UC Davis-based environmental chemistry grant, but...
Jastrow Shields?
Yeah, it's like some endowed thing.
Is that like a space robot? What is that?
No, I think it's a person.
Sorry, Jastrow.
But yeah, I mean, basically it's an older GC that... we replaced with a newer model, so we maybe spent like $1,000-$2,000 on parts and then put it together.
Nice. And you weren't using that piece of equipment, I don't think, but Ariel is the person who is doing the GC work on the Searsol, showing that the torch taste that we all had thought was a product of incomplete combustion is actually more likely caused by secondary combustion products from the high temperature of the torch. True or false?
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
That's what it looks like. And also did some work for us on what happens to lime juice over time as it ages, correct?
Yeah.
And you want to give us the quick spin down on the findings there?
It's looking like rather than finding any specific oxidation products over the course of like 4 to 20 hours, we're actually seeing like an overall reduction in volatiles.
Right. So you think it's – and this Harold McGee, has always been saying that changes like this could often just be the reduction of stuff that's covering other stuff up rather than the creation of new crap. Yeah?
Yeah, definitely. That's totally possible.
You like – can you imagine like paraphrasing McGee with the words crap interspersed every other word? Like, for those of you that know him, like, he doesn't talk that way.
He's very stately.
Yeah, he doesn't – he's not like crap on this, crap – unless he's imitating me, in which case he does. He does a pretty good imitation of me, I think.
I've never heard him do you.
You never heard him do – he does my jersey sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Anyways. Okay, let's do some questions before we get into some other craziness. Like, I had a one more craziness. I had a really bad dream about mashed potatoes last night. I had a horrible –
that's awful.
Yeah, it was horrible. Yeah. Like – well, so it was one of these situations where you're cooking dinner, right? And you let somebody else do something at your house for dinner, you know? It's a dream. Don't worry, people. This didn't happen. And somehow they were mashing purple potatoes. I don't know how the hell that happened in my house because, you know, usually they don't mash so well. But hey, whatever. So, like, whatever. They were mashing the potatoes. And then I looked at the mashed potatoes right before they were going to go out because I was seeing whether they were going to add butter or cream. And, you know, I have my thoughts about both. And it was simultaneously lumpy and gloppy. And I was like, what have you done to the mashed potatoes? And they're like, man, I put it in the food processor. I was like, what? I was like, you know I own both a ricer and a food mill. I own both. I own several of each. I was like, oh my God. I woke up in a sweat. I was like, I woke up and the mashed potatoes hadn't been destroyed that way. But isn't that horrible?
That's awful.
It's horrible. But it reminds me of a very interesting recipe that Nils Noren used to make, where he used to actually put potatoes with a little excess liquid in a VitaPrep and blend them until every single starch granule is completely ruptured and it formed kind of a gluey like potato gloop. And it was actually good, which is a classic example, another thing McGee harps on and I do as well, of taking something that is normally a flaw and pushing it so hard it becomes a benefit again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, enough of my crazy.
Maybe listeners should send us their food nightmares, too, if they have any.
Yeah? Yeah, listeners, yeah. If you have any food nightmares, and I don't mean actual food nightmares like, you know, you incinerated the chicken, although I also appreciate those stories, Jack.
You answer those questions.
I try to prevent you from incinerating them and then tell you why they were incinerated. But, yeah, if you have any actual, like, food, like, nightmares like that, it's, like, similar to the one where, like, you're trying to run away from someone and your feet turn to rubber. You know what that is? It's your feet are asleep.
Yeah. Oh, really?
In the real life, you're in bed, your legs have gone asleep, and then so your legs actually can't move properly when you're asleep, and your body somehow senses this and turns your legs to rubber. Yeah. Yeah. That's my theory.
Nice.
But born by the fact that I've woken up, I have horrible circulation. What the heck? This is not about this.
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Okay. we have a question in. We have a late name for the Searsall. They wanted to name it Salahammer after you, Eustace, because it, you know, looks like a hammer, function of a salamander, and would be your favorite weapon of choice. So Nastasha appreciates it, but as you know, we've already chosen the name. Okay. Ryan Santos writes in, here's a typical Cooking Issues question. I wrote in last week about whether it was worth spending $400 to get all to get a 200 milliliter centrifuge, and I said no. I said I don't think so. You know, no, I wouldn't say so. You mentioned the cheaper Champion model, but mentioned I could get into the 3-liter range for about $1,000. So far, internet digging hasn't found me a model with 3 liters for that price. Can you follow up on that comment with some suggestions for that price quantity? Thanks, Ryan Santos. Well, I don't know whether these guys are all tapped out or not, but look, the trick is this. The company that I buy my centrifuges, the manufacturer of my centrifuges, is out of business. Because it's out of business, you can get fairly good prices on ones that are of semi-recent origin, less than a decade old, right? And some of them haven't seen a lot of use. And the advantage is because they were somewhat common back in the day, there are lots of parts available. The company I use is Juan, which is a French company. Juan was bought by Thermo, right, which is a large manufacturer of all kinds of scientific equipment. Which is, I guess, it's a division of Thermo Fisher, right? Or Thermo Fisher.
I think
division.
So, yeah.
And so anyway, so Thermo bought those guys and then discontinued the Juan brand, right? So most people, when they're buying new centrifuges, most of the chefs I know, they're buying Hettich is what they're buying. I don't know why. I guess they have a good price point or they know – or like, you know, one buys one and then the other buys one. But I know Tony Canoyaro has a Hettich and Wiley both have Hettiches, fairly small footprint. And, but for a non-refrigerated one, I think you're looking at like $7,000, and for, you know, a fully tricked out one, you're probably looking closer to $8,000 to $10,000 with buckets and everything like that. Swinging bucket. You want to go swinging bucket. We can get into that much later about why you would choose a swinging bucket or a fixed angle centrifuge. If anyone actually cares about it, I could talk for a long time about which one you'd prefer. But anyway, in the kitchen, most likely you want a swinging bucket. Just because the fixed angle rotors, unless you have like a very special fixed angle rotor, have very narrow throats on the containers that are in them, and it's very hard to get the product out. Even though technically they pellet a lot faster than a swinging bucket does. Okay, whatever. Again, I don't buy the used ones from Juan can be very cheap. Now I used to buy them for a couple $100. I've talked about them enough. There's not that many out there. So, you know, if 10 people listen to me, then all of a sudden the price jumps and the availabilities go down. That said, there's a company called Ozark Biomedical, and they're somewhere in the Ozarks. God help me. I think they're in Arkansas somewhere. Yes. I think so. Yeah. And Ozark Biomedical specializes in used and like fixing centrifuges. And one of the ones they carry is Juan. They often have reconditioned units, and they can run between $1,200 and $2,500 or $3,000 in that range with buckets and like a 90-day warranty, which is probably good enough. Most stuff's going to break within that period if it's going to break. They'll also make sure that your buckets are sterilized for you so you don't have to go on like bleachrabies.com and get rid of everything out of it. And they make sure that your buckets aren't dinged up so that you're not going to have any like immediate fatigue fractures in a poorly handled bucket, and they make sure that the rotors are good. I mean, the hazards – These centrifuges that rotate at these speeds aren't they're not like ultra fuges or super speeds where you actually have a possibility of what would you call it, breaching the wall of the centrifuge should there be a rotor failure, right? So, you know, once you get into the much larger, much faster models, the energy contained is so great that you can throw even a large piece of equipment across and through a lab, you know? And there are plenty of pictures on the internets of rotor failures in ultra centrifuges. Now, these units, as long as you get a newer unit that has the safety interlocks that you can't run it – well, you can, but I'm not going to talk about it. Run it with the lid open, you know, you're probably not in a life or limb death situation. That said, you don't want to have a rotor failure. And when you buy used, you don't know whether some knucklehead like threw the buckets around. You don't know whether or not they cracked it. You don't know whether they cleaned it with a detergent that is deleterious to aluminum, which is what these buckets are made out of. You don't know whether it's sustained an impact. You don't know anything like this. So sometimes I'll take a chance and I'll look at it and, you know, I'll make a judgment. But I've been using centrifuges for a bunch of years, and I had a bunch of people who had been using centrifuges for years look at my centrifuges before I started running them when I knew nothing about centrifuges. If you go with Ozark Biomedical, you won't be paying that much. You'll be paying like probably a third to less of what you would buy for the equivalent new model, and it's kind of guaranteed to work out of the box. And they're also very friendly and will walk you through the parts of it if you have problems with it. And they carry motors and boards and buckets and all the replacement parts. Hope that – was that helpful?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, okay, all right. Because new ones are expensive. I mean, look, look. I just had someone yesterday. Hey, Dave, where can I buy a new centrifuge? I'm like, you bastard, why is it that we've been doing this for so long and we're still buying scrippity-scrappities off the internet? Do you remember that, like, our new – what's our New Year's resolution, Stas? You remember?
No duct tape, right?
No duct tape on the box. Oh, no. I'm still a fan of duct tape the product, but our box of crap that we show up with will not be duct taped together anymore. We're making the move to new banker's boxes whenever we're moving stuff around by ourselves for no reason.
And having other people move it.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't go that far.
So. We're not there yet.
Come on, please.
Putting on the Ritz.
I told you, it's like, it's Joe, you over there?
Yeah. I'm here. Yeah.
You know how, like, you know when you're a musician and you say every year you're like, man, next year someone else is going to carry my bass rig. You know what I'm saying?
Get a van driver and all that.
Yeah, people are going to carry our crap in and out of the gigs. That ever happen?
No. Of course not.
Yeah, no, it never happens. You always end up carrying your own crap. You know what? 42, still carrying my own crap. I kind of like being able to do it. Kind of keeps you not being whatever.
So I have like a lot of years of carrying my own crap to go. That's what I just got from that. That's awesome.
Yeah, you know what? Like plenty of people, I don't know, or just, you know, don't follow the route where you know, make it a priority to have people carry your crap for you. Like, you know, we always dream but never made it a priority. Look where we are. Anyway, Chad Drazen writes in about this thing. What the heck is this thing? And he points to a link on smokerama.com. Awesome website name, right?
That is a pretty epic website name.
Yeah. You know what they make? Stas, any idea what they make? Ariel, anything?
Is it food or marijuana?
Wow. Good idea. They should get into that business. But they are pressure smoker manufacturers. Mm. Pressure smoker, which I've never used a pressure smoker, but they're like, you can make a barbecue barbecue ribs. They're not from around here, so they don't sound like that. You can make a barbecue rib in like an hour flat. I don't really know that that's the case. You can make a soft rib with a smoked flavor in an hour.
Oh, is this the thing where it cooks the hamburger in like 12 seconds?
Yeah.
Is it like a pressure fryer?
No, well, I mean, presumably they generate the smoke under, like the entire system is sealed under pressure, and then I guess they must use a compressor to evacuate the excess smoke. I have no idea. I didn't have a chance to look that up because this just came to me this morning. But rest assured, we will check it out. People are interested in smoking in every dang environment. People are like, can I smoke in my vacuum machine? Can I smoke in my clothes dryer? Can I smoke? You know, everyone wants to smoke in everything. True or false?
Very true.
Yeah, smoke. Anyway, by Smokerama, the folks who make large pressure smokers. And then in parens, are pressure smokers any good? Again, Chad, I have no idea. Anyway. Okay. So the thing, the title of it, you ready for this? Instant Burger.
Wow.
You like that? I wish we had invented something with that name.
Yeah, seriously.
Instant Burger. Okay. So it cooks precisely measured burgers. And by that, I mean you're supposed to scoop it in like with a scooper.
Delicious.
Yeah. And you're not allowed to put salt on the burger beforehand for reasons that will become apparent. But you can put in onions and bell peppers. But if you do that, you're not making a hamburger. Listen to me, people. Do not put onions and bell peppers raw inside of your hamburger. I think it's a horrible idea. What do you think, Saz?
I think onions are okay.
Raw? I like a big thing of raw onion on top of my burger.
If you put it inside the burger, it'll just get, like, boiled.
Yeah. right?
Yeah, that's not tasty.
There you go. See, take it from the scientist. no offense if that's the way you make your burgers. No offense. Stas is like, you offend everyone, and then say no offense. It doesn't help. But it does. It does. People rarely get offended. Okay. So it cooks precisely measured burgers in 25 seconds without getting hot. Now, that's not strictly speaking true. The burgers get hot. What they mean is there's not a lot of excess heat pumped into the kitchen. Okay. It draws an awful lot of current. I think their manual says 30 amps. Although 30, maybe it's like 20. I don't know. I got to look it up. It runs off a regular 110 line. So it does, I don't know of any 110 appliances that take 30. So it's probably more like 15 or 20. Anyway, is this just an electric chair for burgers? Yes, it is. It claims to cook the hamburgers simultaneously inside and out and only cooks them to well done by design. There's a microprocessor that determines when it's done, I suppose by measuring the current load. How does this work? Love the show. More questions for me to follow. Chad Drazen from 50 Licks LLC. Another good name, 50 Licks. Yeah. Although, no, I'm not going to get into the Tootsie Roll Center of a Tootsie Pop. We already talked about that on the air.
I used to work at an ice cream shop called JP Licks.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jamaica Plain.
Jamaica Plain.
Yeah.
With Licks?
Yeah.
Was it any good?
Yeah, it was really good.
Oh, good. Yeah, good. Good shout out. Okay. So, yes, this is, in fact, an electric chair for hamburgers, and it works on a – so there's direct resistance heating, right? So there's different ways you can heat things, okay? So one is by heating the air near something. This is how, ovens work. Radiant heating by generating large amounts of IR. That's how, infrared broilers work, French fry lamps work, the Searzo. Conduction, those things are all conduction in one way. Well, radiation's not, but the other one, the regular air oven, actually is conduction mixed with convection. Well, I'm not going to get into it. But one way you can generate the microwaves, right, where you're actually causing friction by vibrating the molecules on the inside of the food. That's an internal cooking technique. Another way you can do it is to strap electrodes to something and pass a large amount of current through it, use the object itself as a resistor, and then use the resistance of the food itself to heat the food, right? And that's the principle of ohm, the unit of resistance, heating, resistance heating. Now, a lot of this has been tried, and actually, did I ever talk in the air, Stas, about the electric chair for lobsters?
Maybe.
Well, there's this company in England that tried to make an electric chair for lobsters to shock lobsters to instantly kind of stun/kill them before you boil them, and it's two wet plates, and you pull the wet plates down, and it's conductive, and it like fries the lobster, but you need a very – doesn't fry it. It zorches its nervous system. But you have to use a pretty – I tested it with kind of bad results because the carapace got bent in a weird way. I used regular 60 hertz wall socket 110 voltage with mixed results. I didn't think it was any more humane and didn't make the lobster any more delicious than just cooking it and left scorch marks on the carapace. But anyway, so this was a technique that was touted as a humane way to dispatch lobsters, and I didn't have good luck. But that said, electrostunning is a huge field in both large-value fish like tuna, things like this, and waveform and the way the current is applied is extremely important in terms of how effective it is. But that aside, this is an electric chair. So what they do is you have two conductive plates. You set the thickness of the plate with a spacer on the inside. You smash the thing down. It squishes the burger flat, right? And this is why you don't use salt, because presumably it changes the conductivity of the meat. And they like a specific fat content. They say it's for juiciness, but I'm sure it's also to get a specific conductivity through the meat. You push it down, and from what I can gather on the kind of literature around it and some of the patents around it, it just passes a large electric current through it. I don't know. It's probably measuring, how much load the burger is providing at the beginning versus the end, therefore judging doneness based, I guess, on – I don't know whether they're measuring denaturation or water loss or whatever, but it's like zing and done, and it literally heats the burger by zapping it with the electric current.
That's an interesting idea.
Yeah, and the old models used to have a rare and a well-done knob, and they've removed it because it turns out that they don't want you to actually mess with it. And it's in other words, the people who wanted rare burgers weren't buying the instant burger. It's the people that didn't want to think about things that were buying the instant burger. To the extent that here's their bullet points of how awesome they are. Ready? No cooking oils needed, but you do need a hamburger that's 30% fat. whatever. Anyway, whatever. It's one of those things. No extra cooking oil, as they guess what they mean. I mean, I prefer a burger with more fat. Like, that's one thing I don't like about the Whole Foods hamburger meat, is that they're like, it's 93% lean.
Yeah, definitely.
And horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the point?
No offense, Whole Foods. normally, no hood or venting needed because it's not on very long, right? Here's my favorite. No cooking skills needed. Sweet. Don't you want your hamburger styles made by someone with no cooking skills? Don't worry. We make it in a way that it doesn't matter whether they give a crap or not. Really, it could be a machine pushing the button. Here, enjoy. And cooks out calorie-laden fat, but retains the delicious natural juices. That's just hokum. That's just crap.
Yeah, I don't buy that.
I don't buy that. Cooks out the calorie-laden fat. Anyway, so I thought that was really an interesting thing. Resistive hamburger cooker. Apparently, it will also cook chicken breasts. As long as you, anything you can squish flat between the two plates and get good conduction all the way through, you can cook, and it cooks it very, very quickly. I'm anxious to try one at some point to see whether I like it. Although, if you smash a burger flat and cook the bejesus out of it, I don't really think it matters that much how you cook it.
Hmm. What does it do to the outside, you know?
It looked brown on the website, but it's, you know, it's hard to say, and I don't really know how much this thing costs. I mean, like, I'm a fan of a bunch of different burgers. If you're going to have a thin smash burger, it needs to have plenty mucho grease, and then basically what you're saying is I like the flavor of a beef crust wallowing in grease with hamburger fixings on it and maybe, like, a little bit of meat in the middle that's, you know, still like kind of meat, right? Is this true or false? Am I wrong? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you like a thicker burger, it means you actually want some sort of, like, you know, the texture of like a large protein. Yeah, whatever. I mean, I see both sides, but Nick Solaris, you know, hamburger guru, he likes a smash burger, I think, as well does Josh Ozersky, I think, believes.
I think so, yeah.
Smash burger fan. Modernist cuisine, not so much. They like the big, poofy, open...
The, like, parallel string of meat.
String of meat burger, yeah. Okay. Okay, wait, should we take a break, Jack? I can't see the clock behind the giant modernist cuisine volume. Okay, we're going to take a break. Come back, cooking issues!
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
You know, HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization. If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us in our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation.
And welcome back. Welcome back! Cooking Issues. By the way, Mark Ladner, good friend of ours, Mark Ladner, is doing for the Heritage Radio Network on April 27th. When is that? That's like a week and a half? Week and a half? Is doing an Abruzzi-style Italian barbecue on Saturday, April 27th between 6 and 9. Where's it going to be, Stas? You know? Is it going to be here?
Not sure.
Anyway, Joe, you know where it is?
I'm going to have to do some research, but I'll get back to you.
But the beer's by Harpoon, and the music is by Herbert Spliflington. I wonder whether he enjoys some of the herbal medicine.
No comment on that one.
And you can go to italianbbq.eventbrite.com to buy your tickets for $65. And you know what's worth the ticket price alone, people? Is if you go look at the image they have for it, it's not Mark's whole face. It's just the special Ladner glasses. The special Ladner glasses. Stas, what are your thoughts on the special Ladner glasses? You got getting a shake of the head. Getting a shake off. Pitcher is shaking off the Ladner glasses comment. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. By the way, you still time to call in your question. 2718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Got a question in on soda bottles. Jeff Kanoff at Jeff2486 on the Twitter says, any safety issue with reusing old soda bottles multiple times for the carbonation system that you outlined? What we're talking about is when I carbonate things, I use soda bottles. Usually I use 20 ounces for test batches. I use 1 liters at the bar, 1.5 and 2 liters for events where you know you're going to pour a lot out. Soda bottles are made of PET, right? PET, EP. Anyway, what are those things? One of those things. And I use them multiple times. And is there a safety issue? Not that I'm aware. I mean, I don't believe that they have similar issues to PVC where you get not PVC. Lexan-related things where you cook it in the dishwasher and you get detergents plus it plus heat equals release of nasty chemicals. I don't think that's the case. I think they're fairly neutral. I never put them in the dishwasher. I just do hot water soap rinses and let them dry out. And I'm not aware of any safety issue. The reason I think a lot of times people don't want you to reuse it is kind of bacterial reasons, but we're putting carbonated stuff in them and alcoholic stuff, and we're washing them very thoroughly in between. And all the time in between, they're either dry or they're in a fridge with alcoholic beverage that are carbonated, which are very bacteriostatic in general. You could get yeast, but they're not pathogens, so they're not going to cause problems, not health problems anyway. And so, yeah, I'd say from that standpoint, it's safe. You want to make sure that you use – you could tell when they start to kind of go south on you, and certain newer bottles have like outer layers, I think, that are laminated on for gas barrier properties. But I'm not aware of any safety issues. If you use bottles that are not intended for carbonation, they can explode. So, for instance, if you use Fiji water with the goofy square bottles – that made the millions of dollars, that goofy square bottle. But if you use the Fiji water with the goofy square bottle and you carbonate, it can explode. I remember once – so I'm this kind of guy where I ask once, I ask twice, and then I just scream around and break crap. Is this true or false, does?
That's why
I only ever once got the lady. I only ever asked three times, found my wife, got married, done, right? No, but normally it's like I'm like, where's the bottle? No response. Where's the bottle? No response. And then just grab the Fiji bottle, which is there, and I filled it full of coarse coffee, and I was carbonating it with nitrous to get the nitrous, the nitrous oxide, which gives a creamy feel and brings body back to coffee without giving that prickly sensation that you get out of carbon dioxide. And boom, it blows up and sprays coffee in. Boof, all around the room. So, like, I had a line painted across me of coffee, and there was a line all around the room in this tiny – it's before we were in the trash room, Stas. For a while, I was housed in a closet in the amphitheater. And so the entire closet in the amphitheater had – this is back at the French Culinary – had, like, a line of coffee around it that lasted years. They could never get that thing off. Maybe they repainted over it eventually. So the answer is that they – also, if you heat the bottles with very hot stuff, like if you're trying to do a gel, you need to carbonate it when it's very hot. Aside from the problem that it's hard to get carbonation in things when they're hot because the hotter it is, the less the CO2 wants to go in there, those bottles start losing their structural integrity somewhere probably in the 70s or 80s Celsius. 80s, 90s, in that range, they lose their structural integrity and they can start to balloon out on you, which could be a safety issue because if it explodes when it's hot, it's spraying hot crap everywhere. It's doing more than ruining your jacket. But other than that, I'd say pretty safe. You heard anything, Ariel, on safety?
No, I haven't heard any mishaps.
Yeah. Don't I mean like chemical safety, anything?
I don't think so.
Yeah. But you want to make sure they're not very good gas barriers over the long haul. So you don't want to store a carbonated beverage in it and think that it's going to remain carbonated in perpetuity, right? Another problem with plastics in general, now these plastic bottles are designed not to do it too much. I mean, they're chosen not to do this, but like plastics can do what's called scalp flavors. So especially if you have oil-based flavors that are in there or anything that has kind of a hydrophobic component on it, that can absorb into the plastic. Then the plastic can take on a smell, which then gets transferred to your next batch. And also it can remove enough flavor from things. It's called flavor scalping, that you alter the flavor of your product by the absorption. And like you get this especially in sodas. You'll notice in like low-quality sodas with high levels of suspended oils in them, grape, orange, you'll see the bottles are actually discolored, which is why – and also things like root beers tend to leave aromas in the bottle that are hard to get out, which is why when I'm carbonating, I prefer to buy seltzer bottles because they come neutral. Anyway, just for what it's worth, yeah. Which is probably nothing. Okay. Next question in. From Wine Hacker on Liquid Nitrogen and Vermouth. Hello, Dave, Nastasha, Jack, and Joe. He didn't know you were going to be here.
That's okay.
Yeah, okay. Love the show. Almost through all the back episodes. Now that I have that out of the way, I have a couple of questions. I sent Nastasha an email a couple of weeks ago with some questions about the general use of LN in a bar time environment. She seems to have ignored it, which is fine.
Well, Wine Hacker. Your name is Wine Hacker. So my email recognizes you as spam.
Wow.
Because you decided to name yourself Wine Hacker. So I found it buried in 900 other spam emails.
Wow. Wow. See, this is why we call her the hammer. Like, now, you know, Wine Hacker, you're getting a little taste.
He just got schooled.
This is very instructive. I want people to get a little taste of what it's like when she's not on the air. Like, that's like a little peek through the veil of what it can be like. Anyway, Wine Hacker moderated the comments with, "She seems to have ignored it, which is fine. I often ignore myself, too." Which is very good. Like self-deprecation. Since we are closer to the date of our event, I also have some questions about vermouth. Sorry to have so many questions at once. I hope you can feel free to break the answer into parts so I don't dominate the show. Whatever. I'm just going to do it. Ready? I'm going to do it. The winery where I work is a Union Wine Company in the Willamette Valley, Oregon. You familiar with those people, Ariel?
I've heard of them.
Yeah? Good things?
Yeah. I've never tried their stuff, but I've heard of them.
All right. We'll be having an event in a couple of weeks. The theme is speakeasy. Go ahead and make fun of us for being so original, i.e. not original. Hey. I don't have the energy. I only have a certain amount of energy. Do you have energy to make fun of speakeasies?
No.
She's all tapped out. She's still tapped out with the anger for being called out on air, that she has no more anger to make fun of. Plus, like,
that.
What?
You should be happy that I'm tapped out for the day.
For the whole day? Well, I don't know about that. You'll get a Diet Dr. Pepper. No, Dr. Pepper. I drink whatever. Don't get me started. Okay. Once she gets some caffeine after the show, she'll get her anger back. Don't worry, people. We're going to move things around in the cellar, set up a bar, rent some furniture, and other era-appropriate props to fit the theme. When I began to think about drinks we might serve in addition to our wines, I immediately thought about a podcast a couple of weeks ago and decided to make our own vermouth. We will probably try to keep things fairly simple and offer two drinks. Manhattan and Martini are probably front runners. They're delicious. Mm. Partially since they both use vermouth, though I will need to make a red and a white vermouth. Anyway, one thing I'm thinking about using is liquid nitrogen. Let's do the vermouth section first, because he's about to go into liquid nitrogen, but then go back to vermouth. In terms of vermouth, we started looking at commercial examples, trying to find a couple of benchmarks. We looked at four examples: Carpano Antica, Dolan Rosso, Dolan Blanc. Dolan Blanc and Imbue, an Oregon-made product. The Carpano stood out above everything else, though we like some of the herbal aromatics of the Dolan Rosso. The Dolan Blanc was very nice, though seemingly relatively simple compared to the other three. The Imbue had very interesting aromatics, probably using pine fir or something similar. Are there any other commercial examples you suggest we look at? Currently, I think we will try to make a sweeter red and a drier white. Well, before I get into the other things that you write, I would look at Martelletti. So Martelletti is, I had it first maybe three, four years ago. It started coming into New York, as far as I can tell. And it's very, very good, completely different mouthfeel, thinner mouthfeel, and different kind of aromatic setup from Carpano. And not played out yet, which is good. You know what I mean? Like, it's like people know about it, but not a ton of people know about it. So you can still be kind of the first kid on your block to have it, as far as I know. It's good. Made by the Carpano people, Punta Mess is, yeah. Try that out. And then on the white side, I guess classic, you should try Neu Prat, but, I don't use it much. I actually use Dolan quite a lot for my white. I like the Dolan Blanc, and there's Dolan Dry. And I like their sweeter one better, the Blanc. I tend to use it more than I do the dry, but not for martinis. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Although, bear in mind that the sweet vermouth that you usually put in Manhattans is made from white wine.
Oh, yeah. He mentions it.
Red vermouth is different from...
Well, no, it's red and white only because of the coloring they add, not because it's red and white wine. Yeah. Burr is the only one I think that I know of that's made, is the only aperitif wine that actually starts from a red
base. The Dolan Rosso might actually be from a red wine.
Really?
But there's a Dolan Sweet that I think is...
The Dolan Sweet White or the Dolan Sweet Red. There's, as far as I know, there's the Rosso, the Sweet White, and the Dry.
But I think the Sweet White's closer to a regular
red
sweet vermouth.
Yeah, I like it, actually. I like that product. Anyway, other thing I would go beyond strictly speaking vermouths, and I would go into other aperitif wines, like, for instance, Cokie Americano.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Or if you want something a little on the kind of more mainstream, I guess, Lillet.
Or like Bonal Quinquina.
Yeah, all that stuff's good. So, like, go – and by the way, good websites for the – well, I'll go into what you say. So here's a summary. This is Wine Hacker. Here's a summary of what I think I know about the manufacturing of vermouth. Base wine is nearly always white, sometimes very neutral, sometimes an aromatic variety, muscat, for example. Sometimes it is purposefully aged and oxidized, sometimes not. I'll add also that they often use a wine where they purposely stop fermentation by redoping it, by doping with alcohol before they, right?
Yeah, like port.
Yeah,
so I mean, like not the same as port, but
like
similar
Mistel,
process.
Right, yeah. Okay. Wormwood, cinchona bark, and gentian are the major sources. Bittering can be, true. Botanicals are extracted in alcohol, dilute alcohol, wine, or fortified wine sometimes. Times vary from hours to months. True.
Mm-hmm. Or cooking, too.
Yeah, cooking. Yeah, well, yeah, right. Yeah.
Like heat.
Right, heat, right, sure, yeah. Sometimes extractions are distilled or steam distilled. Of course, that would just be adding a distilled step. Is that true? Yeah,
adding essential oils if you're
steam
distillation.
Sure, that's a fancy way of saying that. Sure, yeah. I mean, could be her, a wine hacker. Sounds like a guy, though.
I think it's a guy.
Yeah. Caramel can be added for coloring. Juice or sugar can also be used. It depends on the standard of identity, right? What kinds of juices can be added?
I think so.
Yeah, I think you have to add grape sugar and or cane sugar, right? No other... Right.
Probably. Yeah, I'd have to look into it.
Total sugar is around 4% for dry and between 10 and 15 for sweet. Final wine must be at least 75% wine, the other 25% consisting of sugar, alcohol, and water. Anything else missing there?
No, I mean, that sounds about right.
Yeah. By the way, remember, vermouth is an acidic ingredient, so a lot of times, and sugar. So people add things that are like, Manhattan doesn't really have any sugar or acid. I'm like, you're wrong.
No, that's BS.
Yeah, it's wrong. Yeah. Okay. I'm looking at a wide range of herbs and flavors. I'm having trouble with color right now. There are three herbs I've found for coloring: red sandalwood, annatto seed, and rosebuds. However, I think I need something more. The color is not a dark enough red. It's a bit too much like an orange-colored rose. I don't want to use more sandalwood because it gives too much woody flavor. Hell yes, it does. Sandalwood?
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Annatto is too orange. I may have to cheat and add a few percent red wine or perhaps find the sandalwood extracts. Any suggestions are appreciated. Can you buy cochineal here?
I'm not sure.
I mean, would you want something that red? That's hardcore
red.
Well,
I mean, I would focus on the flavor more than the color.
Yeah, I mean, because the reds are usually actually more brown.
Yeah, they're sort of brownie orange.
Yeah,
like
so.
Burnt umber.
Yeah, right. So, like, you know, caramel, classic old school caramel color.
Yeah.
But if you can buy cochineal, that's mean, like, it's pretty badass. I don't
know.
Is there an FDA against that? Are we okay? Is that grass here? I don't know. You know, cochineal, crushed up, a.k.a. crushed up bugs.
Dead bugs.
Or, you know, or you could also, I mean, if you wanted to, you could use an anthocyanin that's red at those pHs, but they're not stable. So unless you're not going to use it right away, you know, they're not time stable, they're not heat stable, and they're not light stable. That's been my experience with them. Anyway, any suggestions are appreciated. Okay. Also, how may one sponsor your radio show? Joe, any ideas on that one?
That would be send an email to info@heritageradionetwork.org. And also, the Abruzzi barbecue is going to be at the Heritage Warehouse, which is right around the corner from Roberta's. So that's my info.
Yeah. But go ahead and get yourself your hands on the Martelletti and try that and try those other ones. And try Cokie Americano. We use a boatload of Cokie Americano at the bar. Delicious.
Yeah, I love Cokie.
Yeah, Cokie is good stuff. And an awesome name, Cokie.
Cokie Americano.
Cokie.
That
Cokie.
And Corpse Reviver.
Yeah, Cokie.
Fantastic.
And go to these websites. Go to Vermouth 101, which is run by Martin Dudaroff, which, you know, he's a good fellow. Interesting site that points you to a lot of things. And I don't own it, but, you know, I know Jared Brown and Anastasia Miller, and they wrote a book called The Mixolini Guide to Vermouth and Other Aperitifs. And I haven't read the book, but I know them personally, and so you should go take a look at that. It's available on the Amazon and at Kindle, so you do not even have to wait for it to show up at your door, because Amazon only had a couple copies as of this morning. but anything else about vermouth that you learned from your study of bitters, Ariel?
Well, not so much from the bitters, but in the like V&E section of the UC Davis Library, there's a bunch of copies of Maynard Amerine's like wine production and technology, and that has a pretty good section on vermouth.
Is that when is that from?
There's editions dating back to like the 50s and 60s, like through the 80s.
It's not public record. You know, there's none of it's public record. Can you Google book that thing?
I'd have to look into
Give him the title one more time.
Yeah. Well, Maynard Amerine, I think it's Wine Technology and Production, but I could email you an actual like library entry.
All right, sounds good.
But I mean, like, there might be a. I know there's a lot of like community colleges around there that teach winemaking, so they could have.
Sure. here. Yeah.
Library stuff.
But I mean, he's at a winery. I'm sure he's like, right. Yeah, yeah, okay. So anyway, the other thing is, I'm thinking about using liquid nitrogen to chill the glasses and maybe for nitro muddling. I've read your primer on liquid nitrogen, and we have large 250-liter dewars around the winery. So dewar is what you hold liquid nitrogen in. Actually, anything you put that stuff in is a dewar, but usually when we say dewar, we mean the big dewars. They store the nitrogen under pressure roughly, I think, 20 pounds of PSI, depending on what size dewar you have. The larger 240s, and I don't know 250s. We have 240s. They store at a slightly higher pressure. But anyway, that's what it is. So I will make a phase separator as you show. By the way, so the phase separator is it's just a muffler. It's like a sintered brass muffler that you put on the end of a tube, and it lets you take stuff off of the liquid nitrogen tank. Otherwise, it sprays everywhere. Be aware that on the largers, on the 240s that I've used, they don't come out as smoothly as they come out of the 180s and the 160s. And you can get a little bit of a choo-choo train chugga-chugga-chugga resonance on some of those things. And I think it has to do with the pressure it comes out of. So you might be able to adjust the length of the extract tube to pull it out of to stop it, but we were having resonance issues on a 240 when we had it, and it was like chugging like a choo-choo train. We still got the LN out, and it's not as violent as trying to take it out at pressure, but it wasn't as efficient as it was out of the 180s and the 160s, just a little nota bene. Anyway, my questions are about safety in a bar type environment. I know how to work safely in a cellar, but not at a bar. Do you still use air pots to hold liquid nitrogen, or do you suggest purchasing an insulated dewar flask? Do you remove the internal dip tube from the air pots? Air pots are the coffee things, or can this be used to dispense the LN? Seems like the air pot is not really a closed system, but I'm unsure. If removed, how do you safely dispense the LN? Does not seem like an air pot pours very safely. Any other tips? Okay, here's what I'm going to say about this. I don't use AirPods anymore. I used to use AirPods, the coffee ones with the lids on top, and I used to try to use the little dispensing unit. They aren't sealed. However, the plastic in them can seize up. You can get condensation, and then I've never had one get in a situation that's unsafe. You can always see that they're venting off, but I've gotten it where they no longer dispense properly, and it's true, those ones with the pour tops are very difficult to get to close. At the bar, we use carafes, like thermal coffee carafes and camping thermoses. We buy them from REI because they have a guarantee. And I walked up to the dude at the counter at REI. I'm like, this sucker's got a guarantee. He said, yes. I was like, I'm putting liquid nitrogen in it. This thing has a guarantee. Yes. I was like, so when it breaks, I can bring it back to you. Yes. I was like, okay. So they're sweet, right? Uh-huh. So anyway, so I have the liquid nitrogen, and what we do is we own one at the bar 5-liter dewar, like legit dewar. And then we empty, we fill the 5-liter dewar for service, bring it back behind the bar, and then use that to fill the thermoses. You don't get that much loss out of a thermos, and in a bar situation, you're using it so fast and so much that you don't get that much of an advantage out of capping it. Because remember, when you're not using it, you get a layer of nitrogen vapor above it that provides some insulation, and so you're not getting a huge amount of loss because it's got a very thin, it's got a very small, narrow opening at the top. And those things pour quite well, as opposed to the air pots, which have all that weird nonsense in between the pour spout and you, because you're not meant to pour out of them, you're meant to push a button and have it dispense. So I would move away from the push button dispensers and move towards coffee thermoses, things like this. However, throw away anything that allows you to seal it. Let me speak to you again. Let me say this one more time. Throw away. Don't just like, unless you take it to your house or something like this, do not ever put yourself in a situation where anyone under any circumstances for any reason can make a mistake and screw a sealing lid onto a thermos. I need you to listen to me on this one. This is what caused the poor German cook in Germany years ago to almost die and to lose, I believe he lost like one hand, all of one hand, yeah, almost all the rest of his hand, and I believe one of his legs, and he had to be put in a medically induced coma because he brought to his girlfriend's house liquid nitrogen in a sealed thermos. Never, never make it even a remote possibility that that could ever happen, right?
No, you're making a bomb when you do that.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, but the thing is that I've run into this too, and the older I get, the more I, you know, realize this, especially when I'm working with other people, is that there's a difference between knowing how to not make something unsafe yourself and guaranteeing that no one else can make it unsafe, right? And you want to guarantee that nobody out there can seal up that that container. Also, I think, you know, in light of what happened to the poor person in England, I think whenever you're bringing liquid nitrogen into a bar, you need to do a lot of safety training. And that safety training is one, you know, telling people about the eyes, your eyes, keeping away from the customer, explaining ways in which it, you know, showing how it can be safe, showing how things that they think maybe are unsafe, like getting a little bit on your skin, is not unsafe, at the same time reinforcing all the horrible things that can happen. So, you know, making sure they understand how vitally important it is that liquid nitrogen never, in no cryogen, ever be served, including dry ice, ever be served to a customer in its native state. It's very easy to know that all your liquid nitrogen is gone out of your drink before you serve it. If it's smoking, it's no good to serve to your customer. I mean, it's hammer that stuff home. Hammer home that keep the cryogens away from the customer, not just in service, but you know, throw the extra liquid nitrogen down and behind you. You know, be careful. Let people know that it's real. Let people know that people have gotten hurt when rules haven't been followed. Let them know. Let them know. Read to them the stories of that poor girl who had her stomach removed. Read to them the stories about the German who almost killed himself. Follow basic safety rules. Never let them pour it above their heads. Never, make sure that they don't have a situation where they can pour it into their pockets or get it caught inside of their clothing. Just like, reinforce, read the primer, read other people's primers, reinforce safety like that. The most important thing you can do when you're training new people is to engender in them a healthy respect for the bad things that can happen. I mean, it bears repeating. And a lot of times people think, it's a gimmick. You shouldn't bring in. Lots of things are dangerous. We're just trained to know they're dangerous. We know knives are dangerous. Yeah. We know deep fryers are dangerous. You don't necessarily understand how or why liquid nitrogen is dangerous. Also, if you're dealing in small quantities in a bar, you don't need to get that much into asphyxiation. But you need to make sure a lot of people still, they'll bring large amounts of liquid nitrogen into elevators. Yeah. They'll carry them up stairwells. They'll do all sorts of like awful, awful things with liquid nitrogen that most of the time won't get you killed. But then there's that time when it will. So just look into it. is that what do you think? Is that good? Good?
Yeah.
Okay. So, interesting question in. Got a really interesting one. What time is it?
56.
All right, hold on a second. So I got a good question here, and hopefully I can finish it. Mark writes in. He wrote about nanoparticles before. Do you know anything about nanoparticles, by the way? I don't know anything about it. It was brought to my attention the safety of nanoparticles by Mark recently.
I mean, there are some concerns because they can like breach certain barriers, but they're like too large to be dealt with the way that like regular sized particles are by the immune system.
But the messed up thing is that our ability to produce different ones has outstripped our testing of them.
Crazy.
Gotta jump in. We've got a few great shows on nanoparticles. If you search our archives, Katie Kiefer on Straight No Chaser has done quite a few episodes.
Does she enjoy the nanoparticle?
I don't know.
Nanoparticle fan?
Fan or foe?
Fan or foe. I think you're a fan of the potential.
We'll see. All right. So anyway, thanks for fielding my question. This is Mark writing in. Thanks for fielding my question on nanoparticles. I now have a question that's a bit more technical. I like that it's more technical than nanoparticles. I've been working on making Vietnamese rice noodles using the basic recipe in Charles Fan's book, also available on Epicurious.com. Charles Fan, the chef at Slanted Door in... Right? That's the name of his restaurant, right?
In the Ferry Building in San Francisco.
Yeah, San Francisco. I've made some delicious batches for snacking and staff meal, but they are too short and stick to each other too much to actually serve. After experimenting for a few days, I think that the dough is fine, but the potato ricer that I'm using, back to potato ricers, and by the way, this, like, after I had the nightmare, I read about this. How awful is that? Isn't strong enough tool for a harder dough like this and doesn't make it look pretty. Do you have any suggestions about hacking a potato ricer to get more force or a different kind of tool that could do the same thing or any general advice about making this kind of noodle? Thanks, Mark. Okay. So first of all, to get an idea of what this looks like, I went to Andrea Nguyen's website, vietworldkitchen.com, to look. She reviewed Fan's recipe and also had a video of doing it. She also has what looks like a really cool cookbook that I don't have called Asian Tofu that I now think I need to buy because, all of my tofu stuff comes from like the million years old shirt leaf, book on tofu and miso.
The old school book of miso, yeah.
I told you I called that guy one day, right?
Really?
Yeah, he picked up the phone. I was like, can you make tofu from edamame? He's like, that's a horrible waste of human resources and life. I'm like, oh my God, sorry. Anyway, so I'm anxious to eventually when I'm allowed to buy books again. When I move my apartment, I'm going to be allowed to buy books again, and I'll buy that book. Okay. Anyway, she has a video of it, and the dough is indeed stiff. Look, I think all of these noodles and many noodle tricks in general, and also Dragon's Beard and all this, are really just exercises in water control, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, adding a little bit more water can make a huge change in the rheology of your dough. And so I would say that you could probably – look, the way that these doughs are made is that – the way this dough is made, for those of you who don't know what the heck we're talking about, is you take rice, ground rice in this case, and you soak it sometimes up to 4 days to let it ferment a little bit. And on the blog, they show you different things. You then pour off some of the soaking water and then add fresh water, cook it. Right now you're cooking out a good portion of the starch, mm-hmm. right? That's providing the structure for the dough. So when you're using – when you have a dough that doesn't have its own natural glutens, right, like rice, one of the ways to get structure into it is to cook a portion of the starch before you make the noodles, and that gives you some structure so that it's not just breaking apart and turning into nothing. That's allowing you to form noodles, right? Another way to do it that you see on – if you look on the web to make rice noodles is people will pour a thin layer crepe style into a steamer with a lot of oil. In fact, I saw a really cool video on it and see if I can find the name of the person that I looked it up. On Eat Now, Cry Later, how to make fresh rice noodles. And she paints oil and builds them up layer by layer in a steamer and then peels them apart afterwards so that you don't have to peel off each one individually. And that's pretty cool. So that's one way. But this other technique is the way also you make dumpling wrappers a lot is you pre-cook some – and also choux pastry. Hmm. You pre-cook some of it to give structure, although choux pastry is different because – well, you're retarding the gluten because you have a lot of fat and egg in it, but then you pre-cook it to give it structure. Whatever. So back to where I was. So the point is that then you're pre-cooking it and then you're adding he adds tapioca back, but some people don't. They add more rice, but tapioca is going to give it a springier texture. You control the water level of it, then you extrude it into boiling water, and you form the noodle. So you want to be very careful to have enough water. I would add more water so you can get out of a potato ricer, or I would move to a higher force style situation. So KitchenAid now makes a pasta extruding attachment that actually apparently works. It's $150. I used to have their pasta making attachment for the meat grinder, and it was a little bit less than useless. I don't know if you've ever used that one.
No.
It's useless. I mean, like, the reason it's useless, it's worse than nothing because it makes you think you can do something, and it's just horrible. But apparently the new one works. But there is a style of noodle in the south of India that they make with rice, and they actually use a really bizarre method where they fully cook dumpling dough. They make the dough. They do the soaking. They grind it wet, make a dough, cook it in a pan, then form it, then boil the dumplings, then take the hot dumplings and extrude them through a noodle extruder. But they make noodle presses for that you can get at Indian stores. Call it Savai Press. I don't know how you pronounce it, but I think Savai Press. But really interesting stuff there, and I hadn't known about that. But one thing I did know about is they make something, and I'm going to mispronounce it, called a chakli press. Those are the fried Indian fried like dal and flour rice. I think rice or whatever flour noodles that you extrude through an extruder and fry, and they look like a cookie press, but like brass and long. And those things would work for this because they have screw pressure in it, so you can screw the sucker down and extrude it out. I would A, try to make a looser dough, and I would B, try to use one of these screw things that you can get at an Indian shop. Now, that said, reading about this, I went ape loony, right, and started doing – and my entire morning was shot because I was looking stuff up, and I'll give you a couple things. There's a guy, and this is how you find it. You look up – my notes are holy crap. What you look up is making rice noodles – Chongqing, China, okay? And there's a Google, there's a YouTube, and here's what this guy does. You guys familiar with Ublek?
Yeah, the like cornstarch water.
Yeah. So like a non-Newtonian fluid is a fluid that doesn't act where you know the viscosity of it changes markedly depending on whether or not it's being agitated, right? Non-Newtonian fluid. So, you know, a lot of things are what's called shear thinning. So the harder you stir them, and the more force you apply to them, the more liquid they get, which makes sense because, you know, the things that form a mat, you hit them hard enough and the strands align and all of a sudden it becomes easier to shear through them, shear thinning. Well, there are things that the harder you work them, the more difficult they are. And Ublek is one of them. And Ublek is made out of cornstarch and water. And you can go online and see these guys – there's a video called people running on a pool of oobleck. It's awesome. Running across, like literally running across it, like walking on water and then stopping and sinking into it, and it's like chest deep. It's strong.
It's like quicksand.
Yeah, it's strong. Yeah, it's good. But this guy in Chongqing, China, and I've no idea, he made some form of oobleck noodle thing. So he has what amounts to just a strainer that he's holding in his hand, right? And he scoops out of a bucket handfuls of dough that appear to be a solid, scoops them up, throws them into the strainer, and then at the bottom where there's no force on them, they're straining out like a liquid. And he does that a bunch of times until it looks like it's what he wants it, and then he holds the oobleck over the water into boiling water and makes noodles that he then cooks for a couple seconds, scoops out, and then throws them in the thing. I was like, oh my God.
That's so
cool. Right?
Yeah.
Hence my notes. Holy crap. Holy crap. And, further on this, I got back on the noodle thing, and I was looking at it. Chef Tom out in California, who's with what currently is the International Culinary Center out there in near San Jose, he did a video on hand-pulled noodles, and I went to go look, because I got back into hand-pulled noodles. Every once in a while, I've never gotten good at it, by the way. But I've noticed there's two varieties of the hand-pulled noodles. So most of the times, like when it's attempted in English-speaking posts on the internet, the hand-pulled noodle style is one where the first step is to completely obliterate the gluten structure by over-kneading the hell out of it, right? And if you want to know about this, by the way, it's another thing do yourself a favor. If you're at all interested in how wheat scientists measure doughs, and you don't have access to like the expensive books, and you don't want to go go on Google Books and read all of Hosni's stuff by like pasting and cutting between all of the different books, like cereal science and all that, go look at http://www.wheatflourbook.org. And wheatflourbook.org has all of the things of how wheat is rated by cereal chemists when it comes in and how things are done. And for instance, they say a sample of wheat is considered infested if it contains – and this strikes me as very odd. Ready? A sample of wheat is infested if it contains, one, two or more live weevils, right? Two, one live weevil and one other live insect injurious to stored grain, right? Or three, two or more live insects who are injurious to stored grain other than live weevils. That's dumb. Any two insects, they don't care. They're like, it can be two weevils or a weevil and another insect or two insects.
What's the sample size for that? Is it like per kilo or?
I don't know. Is a weevil, maybe a weevil's not an insect. Maybe it's technically something else.
I don't know. Maybe.
It's not an insect? I mean, I know it's
a like
bug.
An arthropod?
Yeah, it's a bug. Yeah, it's a bug, but maybe it's not actually like an insect from a technical standpoint. And so that's why they have
eight legs or something.
But one thing would have been sufficient. Any combination of two or more live insect or weeviloid things, it counts as infested. So here's another one. Definition of light, smutty wheat. Wheat in a 250-gram portion that has an unmistakable odor of smut or which contains smut balls. Portions of smut balls or spores of smut. In excess of a quantity equal to 5 smut balls, but not in excess of a quantity equal to 30 smut balls of average size, is light, smutty wheat.
I think average size smut ball is going to be my next band name.
Whoa.
Right? Check this out. Here's one more for you from this awesome, awesome book. At the end of the book, there are standards from the American Association of Cereal Chemists of recipes with which to test flours. So, like, when they're like, they have, like, the standard sugar snap cookie. They have ginger or whatever. They have, like, the standard. And they also have something called the Asian noodle texture test. And it literally is, like, you line up cooked noodles, and they have a plastic tooth that pushes down into it, right? And a sample of 5 noodle strands are randomly selected and cut into 7-centimeter pieces. The 5 noodle pieces are laid side by side on the TA.XT2 texture analyzer instrument platform. A 2-bite compression test is performed using a special plastic tooth. Compression is performed to 70% of noodle thickness and then released and then redone again. And it's like literally they have an Asian noodle texture test. I mean, this document is – And why it's important. Noodle texture is an important quality characteristic. Oh, really? I had no concept. This book is available for free, people. This is free. Like, this is like – this is what I'm being told that I have to leave. Hold on a second. Before I leave, so go check out the wheatflourbook.org. And I found that because I had to look up. They have like one of the tests they use is they make a disc of dough and they inflate a bubble into it to see how it extends, right? It's called an alveolograph, alveoli in your lungs. Yeah. And so I read that in the Paula Figoni's book, How Baking Works, Exploring the Fundamentals of Baking Science, which I hear is really good, but I don't own a hard copy of. Another one that I need to go buy a copy of. Anywho, so the end of the story is that I was looking up as usual, it all ends up back in hand-pulled noodles. And I was noticing that because hand-pulled noodles are interesting because they have to have extraordinarily long extension, mm-hmm. right, without snapping. So you would think very low gluten or, you know, a weak gluten flour so that they won't snap back, right? Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it seems to me that there's two main ways that it's done. So if you look at like the ones that are done in English, they put things typically in a mixer and they just destroy the gluten, obliterate it, wipe it out, the same way that you do for beaten biscuits, which is something that I can make properly, right? Gluten is just obliterated by overmixing. Then you have the ones – and those ones, when you're looking at them hand-pulling the noodles, they pull slowly kind of evenly – and they just pull it across, and you can see that the noodles like almost want to pull themselves into noodle shape, mm-hmm. right? And then you look at the ones with no speaking that are done most of the time in Asia where it's just some guy on the street doing it. And those guys have an entirely different technique. Like the end section of their kneading, right, first they do the tearing and ripping and destroying it, and you can tell that they're putting water in. They're doing water control. Same way as soba, like proper soba manufacturer, all about water control, mm-hmm. all back to water control. And you can see them when they get the texture right, but then their final kneading process is a stretching, aligning, and rolling where they're actually looks like they're aligning. And after they start doing that, they never again go cross or rotate. They're always just, you know, just torsion and stretch back, torsion, stretch, and then cut off little pieces, and they're always going in the same thing. And those guys, right, those guys, when they're pulling the noodles, it's like slap a rap dap rap dap a dap slap dap dap, and they're pulling hard, right, mm-hmm. and they're slapping the noodle around, which means that that sucker must have more structure. Now, the ones that I've tried to learn from have always been the Western-style ones, and those are premised on the fact that there's no internal structure one way or the other. They just beat the crap out of them, and I've always found that most of those noodles don't have a lot of bite. My question is to everyone out there who's tried it, is there a fundamental and qualitative difference between the slap-a-rap-dap and the beat-the-hell-out-of-hand-pulled noodles? I have no idea. Cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.